I was sure I'd have to keep plucking and strumming for the rest of my life, however short that might be. "Recall my plight," he cried, leaping to his feet. "Alone with a ferocious monster, bard against beast, beast against bard." "You slew her," Taran exclaimed, "a bold stroke, though a pity, for she was beautiful in her way."
Well, the truth of it is,"
Fluda said hastily, for the harp strings had tensed, as though they might all break at once.
"She finally went to sleep. I snatched up our swords and ran for dear life."
Fluda sank back to the turf and immediately began munching the food Gergi had offered him.
"But I shouldn't vouch for Lian's temper when she wakens," the bard continued. "She's bound to come after me. These mountain cats are trackers born, and since Lian's 10 times bigger than an ordinary creature, she's surely 10 times more cunning. She'll not give up easily. I have the feeling her patience is as long as her tail. But I'm surprised you've not gone farther. I thought you'd be well on your way to join the search."
Taran shook his head. He told the bard of the decision to return to Dinas Ridnant.
"I suppose it's the best thing to do," Fluda reluctantly agreed, "especially now, when Lian may be prowling."
Taran scanned the hills for the easiest and safest path to follow. He caught his breath. A dark shape sped high above. It veered, circled, then dove directly toward him.
"It's Kor!"
Taran ran ahead and held out his arm. The crow dropped swiftly and lighted on Taran's outstretched wrist. The bird showed signs of grueling flight. His feathers were askew, and he looked like a bundle of rags. But he clacked his beak and jabbered excitedly.
"Ilanwe!"
Kor croaked.
"Ilanwe!"
Chapter 9. The Luck of Rune.
"He's found her!"
Taran shouted, as the companions pressed around the frantic crow.
"Where has Mag taken her?"
"Alor!"
croaked Kor.
"Alor!"
"The river?" Taran exclaimed. "How far is it?"
"Close! Close!" replied Kor.
"No question of going back to Dinas Ridnant now," cried Prince Rune. "Mag's in our hands. We'll have the princess back again in no time at all."
"If Lian doesn't have us in her paws first," muttered Fluda.
He turned to Taran.
"Can Kor bear word to the Master of Horse? I don't mind telling you, I should feel safer with a few warriors behind me."
"We dare not lose time," Taran answered. "Prince Rune is right. We must act now, or Mag will slip through our fingers." "Quickly, old friend," he said to Kor, urging the crow aloft. "Guide us to the Alor." They set off in haste. The crow fluttered from one tree to the next, jabbering impatiently until the companions drew closer. Then, launching himself once more into the air, Kor streaked onward in the direction he wished them to follow. The crow, Taran knew, was doing his best to bring them as quickly as possible out of the hills. But many times, the forest and underbrush formed such a tangled barrier, the companions were forced to draw their swords and hack their way through. Their path did not ease until well past midday, when Kor led them across a low, rolling plain, which soon fell into pebbly ravines. The turf was short and stubbly, with many splotches of bare ground where chalk-white boulders were strewn like giant hailstones.
"With all of Rudlam's warriors combing Mona,"
Fluda cried angrily, as they began their descent toward the river,
"how has that spider managed to escape us for so long?"
"Mag has been more cunning than we thought," Taran said bitterly. "I'm sure he took Ilanwe into the hills of Paris, but he must have hidden away without moving until he knew the search had swept beyond him."
"The villain," Fluda snorted. "So it must have been. While we all went tracking farther and farther away from the castle, that foul Mag waited at his ease until we'd gone so far ahead that he was behind us. No matter. We'll soon have him by the heels, and he'll pay for that trick."
Kor, circling in great loops above the companions, had grown more agitated and began a raucous croaking. Taran caught a glimpse of the Alor flashing below. Kor, in a great burst of speed, flew directly toward it.
With Prince Roon gasping and puffing behind them, the companions ran down the slope. Kor, lighting on a branch, madly flapped his wings. Taran's heart sank. There was no trace of Ailanui or Mag. In another moment, he dropped to one knee.
"Fluda!" he shouted. "Quickly! Here are hoofprints! 2 horses!"
He followed the trail for a few paces, then halted, puzzled.
"See this," he said to the bard and Gergi, who had come up beside him. "The tracks follow different paths. I don't understand what could have happened.
Prince Roon," he called, "can you see anything of the steeds?" No answer came from the Prince of Mona. Taran leapt to his feet and spun about.
"Roon!"
he cried. But there was no sign whatever of the prince.
"He's wandered off again!" Taran shouted furiously. "Feckless dolt! Where has he gone?"
Calling anxiously for Roon, the 3 raced onto the riverbank. Taran was about to set off alone to seek him, when the Prince of Mona appeared from a stand of willows.
"Hello! Hello!"
Roon hurried forward, beaming delightedly. Before the relieved but angry Taran could take him to task, the prince called out,
"Look at this! Amazing! Really astonishing!"
Prince Roon held out his hand. In it lay Ailanui's bauble. His heart pounding, Taran stared at the golden sphere.
"Where did you find this?"
"Why, over there,"
answered Roon, pointing to a moss-covered rock.
"While you were looking at hoofprints, I thought I might go and search somewhere else to save us time, and this is what I found."
He handed the bauble to Taran, who carefully tucked it into his jacket.
"He's led us to fresh tracks," said Fluda, studying the grass. "Something fairly large and flat has been dragged along here."
He scratched his chin thoughtfully.
"I wonder, a boat? Could it be? Did that sneering spider have one ready and waiting? I shouldn't be surprised if he had planned it all before Ailanui reached Mona."
Taran strode down the bank.
"I see footprints," he called. "The ground is badly torn. Ailanui must have struggled with him. Yes, right there. And there she would have dropped the bauble."
In dismay, he looked at the wide, rapid-flowing Alor.
"You have read the signs well, Fluda," he said. "Mag had a boat here. He said loose the horses and let them run as they pleased."
Taran stood a moment watching the turbulent water, then drew his sword.
"Come, lend me a hand," he called to Gergi and the bard, and ran to the willows.
"I say, what have you in mind?"
cried Roon, as Taran chopped hastily at the lower branches.
"Making a fire? There's hardly any need."
"We can build a raft," replied Taran, throwing the cut branches on the ground.
"The river has helped Mag. Now it shall help us." The companions ripped vines from the tree trunks and lashed the cut branches together, lengthening the makeshift cords with strips torn from their own garments. Ungainly though it was, and looking more like a bundle of kindling wood, the raft was soon ready. But no sooner had Taran begun tying the last knots in the tangle of vines and rags than Gergi shrieked in fear. Taran leapt to his feet and spun around as Gergi gestured wildly toward the trees farther up the riverbank. Lian had burst from the woods. The great, tawny mountain cat halted for an instant, one paw raised, her tail lashing, her eyes blazing at the companions, who fell back in terror.
"The raft!" Taran shouted. "Into the river with it!"
He seized one end of the clumsy craft and struggled to haul it to the water. Still yelling, Gergi ran to aid him. Prince Roon toiled as best he could to help. The bard had already splashed into the stream, where he stood hip-deep in the current and heaved at the branches. Lian's tufted ears cupped forward, and her whiskers twitched as her glance fell on the bard. From her throat arose not a savage roar, but a bell-like, questioning cry. Eyes shining with a strange glow, she loped forward on huge padded paws. Purring loudly, the mountain cat made straight for the frantic bard.
"Great Belin!" cried Fluda. "She wants me back again!"
It was then that Kor, perched on a low branch, beat his wings and launched himself against Lian. Squawking and croaking at the top of his voice, the crow swooped down on the astonished beast. Lian stopped in her tracks and roared angrily. Flying at full speed,
Kor passed within a hairbreadth of Lian's mighty head, striking out with his wings and pecking at her with his sharp beak. Taken by surprise, Lian fell back on her haunches and turned to face the crow. Kor veered in a tight circle and swooped again. Lian sprang into the air, claws unsheathed and slashing. Taran cried in dismay as a cloud of feathers floated downward, but an instant later he saw the crow still aloft and plunging again toward Lian. Dancing in front of her like a large black hornet, Kor jabbered impudently as though daring the beast to catch him, flapped his wings in her face, and sped away once more. At his next dive, which brought him so close that Lian's teeth snapped shut on one of his tail feathers, Kor seized and tweaked a curling whisker. Yowling furiously, forgetting the bard and the struggling companions, Lian raced after the crow, who flapped from the riverbank into the woods. Lian followed, and her roars echoed among the trees. With a final heave, the companions flung the raft into the river and scrambled aboard. The current snatched and spun the craft, nearly capsizing it before Taran could thrust a pole into the water. Fluda and Gergi fended the raft off a threatening boulder. Prince Rune, drenched to the skin, paddled desperately with his hands. In another moment, the raft righted itself, and the companions skimmed rapidly downstream. Fluda, whose face had turned deathly pale, gave a sigh of relief.
"I feared she had me for sure. Believe me, I couldn't stand another bout of harping like the last one. I hope Kor fares well," he added anxiously.
"Kor will find us again," Taran assured him. "He's clever enough to stay out of Lian's reach until he knows we're safe. If she keeps chasing him, I'm certain she'll have the worst of the battle." Fluda nodded, then turned and glanced back over his shoulder.
"In a way," he said, with a note of regret in his voice, "it's the first time my music has really been, in a manner of speaking, sought after. In this case, if it weren't so dangerous, I should call it downright complimentary."
"I say," called Prince Rune, crouching at the front of the raft, "I don't mean to complain after all the work you've done, but I think something's breaking loose." Taran, busy steering, glanced down in alarm. The hurriedly knotted vines had begun to give way. The raft shuddered in the swift current. With the pole, Taran thrust deeply for the river bottom, seeking to bring the raft to a halt. The current bore it onward, and the branches bent and twisted as the water poured through the gaps. One of the vines parted, a branch ripped free, then another. Throwing aside the useless pole, Taran shouted for the companions to jump clear. Seizing Prince Rune by the jacket, he sprang into the river. As the water closed over his head, Prince Rune kicked and struggled wildly. Taran tightened his grasp on the foundering prince and fought his way to the surface. With his free hand he clung to a boulder and gained a foothold among the shifting stones. Heaving with all his strength, he dragged Rune ashore and flung him to the bank. Gergi and Fluda had managed to catch hold of what remained of the raft and were hauling it into the shallows. Prince Rune sat up and looked around.
"That's the closest I've ever been to drowning," he gasped. "I've often wondered what it was like, though now I don't think I care to know."
"Drowning?" said Fluda, staring at the wreckage of the craft. "Worse than that. All our labor has gone for naught."
Taran rose wearily to his feet. "Most of the branches can be used. We'll cut more vines and start again." The discouraged companions turned to the task of repairing the raft, now strewn in pieces along the bank. The work went more slowly than before, for the trees grew sparser here and vines were scarce. The Prince of Mona had made his way to a clump of osiers, and Taran glimpsed him tugging away, trying to uproot them. The next instant, Rune was no longer in sight. With a shout of alarm, Taran dropped his armload of vines and ran toward the spot, calling Rune's name. The bard looked up.
"Not again," he cried. "If there were a field with one stone, he'd trip over it. A flam is patient, but there are limits."
Nevertheless, he hurried to join Taran, who was already kneeling among the osiers. At the spot where Rune had been standing was a gaping hole. The Prince of Mona had vanished. Chapter 10 The Cavern. Heedless of Fluda's warning shout, Taran leapt into the pit and slid quickly past a mesh of torn roots. The hole widened a little, then dropped straight. Calling for the bard to lower a length of vine, he let himself fall, then scrambled to his feet and struggled to lift up the unconscious Rune, who was bleeding heavily from a gash at the side of his head. The end of the vine dangled from above. Taran seized and lashed it securely under the prince's arms, shouting for Fluda and Gurgi to pull him up. The vine tautened, strained, and snapped. Earth and stones showered from the raw sides of the hole.
"Beware!" Taran cried. "The ground is giving way!"
"Afraid you're right," Fluda called back. "In that case, I think we'd better give you a hand from down there."
Taran saw the soles of Fluda's boots plunge toward him. The bard landed with a grunt, and Gurgi, whose hair looked as though it had scraped away most of the dirt from the hole, tumbled after. Prince Rune's eyelids fluttered.
"Hello, hello," he murmured. "What happened? Those roots were surprisingly deep."
"The land must be eaten away along the riverbank," Taran said. "When you pulled, the strain and weight opened up this hole." "Never fear," he added quickly. "We'll soon have you out. Help us to turn you. Can you move at all?" The prince nodded, gritted his teeth, and, with the companions lifting him, began painfully clambering up the side of the pit. But he had gone no more than halfway when he lost his handhold. Taran scrambled to block his fall. Rune clutched wildly at a root, and hung poised a moment in mid-air. The root tore free, and Rune plummeted downward. The wall of earth rumbled as the pit collapsed around them. Taran flung up his arms against the rush of soil and shale. He was thrown down. The ground cracked at his feet, fell away, and left him spinning in nothingness. A violent shock stunned him. Loose earth filled his nose and mouth. Lungs bursting, he fought against the weight, pressing the life from him. It was only then he realized he had stopped falling. His head still reeled, but he twisted and clawed his way through dirt and pebbles. He heaved himself upward, breathing once again. Gasping and trembling, he dropped at full length on a sloping, rocky floor, in darkness so deep it seemed to suffocate him. At last, regaining strength enough to lift his head, he tried vainly to peer through the shadows that filled his eyes. He called to the companions, but no answer came. His voice rang with a strange, hollow echo. In despair, he shouted once more.
"Hello! Hello!"
called another voice.
"Prince Rune!" Taran cried. "Where are you? Are you safe?"
"I don't know,"
answered the prince.
"If I could see better, I could tell you better."
Raising himself to hands and knees, Taran crawled forward. His groping fingers met a shaggy mass that stirred and whimpered.
"Terrible! Oh, terrible!" moaned Gurgi. "Rumblings and crumblings fling poor Gurgi into fearsome blackness. He cannot see."
"Great Belin," came Fluda's voice out of the dark. "I'm delighted to hear that. For a moment I thought I'd been struck blind. I swear I can see more with my eyes shut."
Ordering Gurgi to hang onto his belt, Taran crept in the direction of the bard's voice. Soon the companions had found each other again, and also Prince Rune, who had managed to drag himself toward them.
"Fluda," Taran said in an anxious voice, "I fear the landslide has blocked the pit. Dare we try to dig our way out?"
"I don't think it's so much a question of digging as it is of finding, if you take my meaning," replied the bard. "Whether we can burrow through all this dirt is, to say the least of it, highly doubtful. Even a mole would have trouble, though I'm willing to give it a try. A flam is undaunted. But," he added, "without a light to guide us, we shall spend the rest of our days looking for the right spot to dig."
Taran nodded and knitted his brow. "It's true. Light is as precious to us as air." He turned to Gurgi. "Try to use your flints. We have no tinder here, but if I can catch the spark in my cloak, it may be enough to set it alight." He heard rustling, slapping sounds as though Gurgi were searching himself all over, and then a dismal wail.
"Firestones are gone," Gurgi moaned. Wretched Gurgi cannot meet bright blazing. He has lost them, oh misery and sorrow. Gurgi will go alone to seek them.
Taran patted the creature's shoulder. Stay with us here. I value your life more than firestones. We shall find some other way.
Wait, he cried. Ilanwi's bauble. If only it will light for us.
Quickly he thrust into his jacket and drew out the sphere. For a moment he held it covered in his hands, fearing disappointment should the bauble fail to glow. Holding his breath, he slowly moved a hand away. The golden sphere lay cupped in his palm. He could feel its smooth, cool surface and its weight, which was somehow not weight at all. He sensed the eyes of the companions on him and could guess at their hopeful glances. But the darkness pressed heavier and more stifling than ever. The bauble gave not the slightest glimmer.
I cannot do it, Taran murmured. I fear it is not given to an assistant pig-keeper to command such a thing of beauty and enchantment.
No sense in my trying, said Prince Rune. I know I can't make it work. The very first time I held it, the thing blinked out the moment it was in my hands. Surprising! The Princess Ilanwi could light it so easily.
Taran groped toward Fluda and put the sphere into his hand.
You know the lore of the bards and the ways of enchantments, he urged. Perhaps it will obey you. Try, Fluda. Our lives depend on it.
Yes, well, replied Fluda, I must admit I have no great skill in these things. The true lore of the bards, sorry to say, has always been a little beyond me. There's simply too much to know, and I could never squeeze more than a drop or two into my head. But a flam is willing.
Moments passed, then Taran heard Fluda sigh with discouragement.
Can't get the hang of it, muttered the bard. I even tried wrapping it on the ground, but that doesn't do either. Here, let our friend Gurgi have a go at it.
Woe and sorrow,
moaned Gurgi, after the bard had passed the sphere to him and he had held it for a while.
Even with teasings and squeezings, even with battings and pattings, unhappy Gurgi cannot bring golden winkings.
A flam never despairs, cried Fluda. But, he added dolefully, I'm coming rapidly to believe this pit will be our grave, without even a decent mound to mark the spot. A flam is cheerful, but this is a disheartening situation, no matter how you look at it.
Gurgi silently gave the bauble back to Taran, who, heavy-hearted, cupped it in his hands again. With yearning now he held it, and his mind turned from his own plight to thoughts of Ilanwi. He saw her face and once more heard her gay laughter ring clearer than the notes of Fluda's harp. He smiled to himself, even as he recalled her chattering and her sharp words. He was about to return the bauble to his jacket, but stopped short and stared at his hand. A point of light had begun to flicker in the depths of the sphere. As he watched, not daring to breathe, it blossomed and shimmered. Taran sprang to his feet with a cry not of triumph, but of wonder. Golden beams shone around him faintly but steadily. Trembling, he raised the sphere high above his head.
"Kind master saves us," cried Gurgi. "Yes, yes, he takes us from loomings and gloomings. Joy and happiness, fearful darkness is gone. Gurgi can see again."
"Amazing," cried Prince Rune. "Astonishing. Look at this cave. I never knew we had such a place on Mona."
Again Taran cried out in wonder. Until now he had believed they had fallen into something like a large burrow. The glow of Ilanwi's bauble showed they had come, instead, to the edge of an enormous cavern. It stretched before them like a forest after an ice storm. Columns of stone rose like the trunks of trees and arched to the ceiling where stone icicles clung. Along the shadowy walls, huge outcroppings sprang like hawthorn blossoms and glittered in the bauble's golden rays. Threads of scarlet and vivid green twisted through luminous shafts of rock. White tendrils of crystal curled along jagged walls gleaming with rivulets of water. Still other chambers lay beyond this one, and Taran caught sight of wide pools, flat and glistening as mirrors. Some gave a dull, greenish glow, others a pale blue.
"What have we found?"
Taran whispered. Can this be a part of the Fair Folk's realm? Fluda shook his head.
The Fair Folk surely have tunnels and caves where you'd least expect them, but I doubt this is one. There's no sign of life at all.
Gurgi did not speak, but stared with round eyes at the cavern. Prince Roon, an expression of delight on his face, stepped ahead.
I say, this really is surprising, he said. I shall have to tell my father about this, and see if he won't open it up to visitors. It would be a shame to keep it hidden away.
It is a place of great beauty, Taran said in a hushed voice.
And a deadly place for us, replied Fluda. A flam enjoys the scenery. That's one advantage of being a wandering bard. But from the, outside, if I make myself clear, which I believe is where we should put ourselves as quickly as we can.
The companions retraced their steps to where the landslide had carried them. As Taran had feared, the light of the golden ball showed that digging a passage would be in vain, for heavy boulders filled the pit, blocking it entirely. While Prince Roon rested on one of the table-like stones, and Gurgi delved into his wallet for food, Taran and Fluda spoke hastily between themselves.
"We must find another passage," Taran said. "King Rudlam and his men will never reach Ailanwy now. We're the only ones who know the direction Mag has taken."
"All too true," Fluda glumly replied. "Yet I fear that knowledge is going to stay locked up with us here. Akron herself couldn't have thrown us into a stronger prison." "There are surely other ways in and out," the bard went on, "but these caverns can stretch who knows how far. Underground they may be enormous, and the entry no bigger than a rabbit hole."
Nevertheless, they agreed they had no choice but to continue into the cavern and seek a passage leading them above ground. Keeping the Prince of Mona protectively between them, Taran and the bard set off through the forest of stone, with Gurgi trotting behind and clutching Taran's belt. Without warning, Prince Roon suddenly cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted,
"Hello! Hello!"
at the top of his voice.
"Anyone here? Hello?"
"Roon," Taran cried, "be silent! You will bring more danger on us."
"I should hardly think so," answered Roon innocently. "It seems to me that finding someone or something is better than finding nothing at all."
"And risk our necks doing so?" Taran retorted.
He halted until the echoes had died away. No further sound came from the reaches of the cavern, and Taran warily beckoned the companions forward. The ground dipped, and they found themselves amid stones that jutted like huge teeth from the ground. Farther on, the cavern floor rolled and twisted in high waves and deep valleys, as though a stormy sea had been frozen motionless. Another chamber held massive piles of rock and tall mounds that had taken the fanciful shapes of unmoving clouds. Here the toiling companions rested a moment, for the path had narrowed and grown more difficult. The air was heavy, stagnant as swamp water, and chilled them to the bone. Taran urged them to their feet once again, anxious to find a tunnel leading upward, but fearing more and more that their search would be long and painful. A glance at the bard's face told Taran that Fluda shared his fears.
"I say, there's an odd thing," called Roon, pointing to a tumble of rock.
It was indeed one of the strangest shapes Taran had seen in the cavern, for it looked like a hen's egg sticking halfway out of a nest. The stone was white, smooth, and somewhat pointed at the top, crusted here and there with patches of lichen, and stood nearly as tall as Taran himself. What at first resembled a nest was a tangled, discolored fringe of coarse strands that seemed to balance on the edge of a sharp drop.
"Amazing,"
called Roon, who had insisted on striding closer to peer at it. "This isn't a rock at all." He turned in surprise to the companions.
"This is unbelievable, but it's almost like—"
Taran seized the astonished Roon and dragged him backward so abruptly the prince nearly went head over heels. Gurgi yelped in terror. The shape had begun to move. Two colourless eyes appeared in a face pale as a dead fish. The eyebrows glittered with flecks of crystal. Moss and mould edged the long, flapping ears and spread over the beard that sprouted below a lumpy nose. Swords drawn, the companions huddled against the jagged wall. The huge head continued to rise, and Taran saw it wobble on a skinny neck, A choking noise bubbled in the creature's throat as it cried,
"Puny things! Tremble before me! Tremble, I tell you! I am glue! I am glue!"
Chapter 11. King of the Stones. Gergi flung himself to the ground, covered his head with his hands, and whimpered piteously. The creature threw a long, spindly leg over the ledge and began slowly drawing himself upright. He was more than thrice as tall as Taran, and his flabby arms dangled below a pair of knobby, moss-covered knees. With a lopsided gait, he shambled toward the companions.
"Glue!" Taran gasped. "But I was sure..."
"It can't be," whispered Fluda. "Impossible. Not little glue. Or if it is, I certainly got the wrong impression of him."
"Tremble!" the quavering voice cried again. "You shall tremble!"
"Great Belin!"
muttered the bard, who was indeed shaking so much he had almost dropped his blade.
"I don't need to be told."
The giant bent, shaded his white eyes against the light of the bauble, and peered at the companions.
"Are you really trembling?" he asked in an anxious voice. "You're not doing it just to be obliging."
Gergi, meantime, had ventured to lift his hands from his face, but the sight of the creature towering above him made him clap them back again and set him to wailing louder than ever. Prince Roon, however, recovering from his first shock, studied the monster with great curiosity.
"I say, this is the first I've seen anyone with toadstools growing in his beard," he remarked. "Did he do it on purpose, or did it just happen that way?"
"If that's the glue we know," said the bard, "he's changed remarkably."
The giant's pale eyes widened. What would have been a smile on a face of ordinary size became a grin that stretched longer than Taran's arm. Glue blinked and stooped closer.
"You've heard of me, then?"
he asked eagerly.
"Indeed we have," put in Roon. "It's amazing, but we thought Lian..."
"Prince Roon," Taran warned. Glue, for the moment, seemed to have no wish to harm them. Instead, evidently pleased by the consternation he had wrought among the companions, he was looking down at them with an expression of satisfaction, all the more intense because it was so large. But until he had learned more of this strange creature, Taran had deemed it wiser to say nothing of their search.
"Lian?"
Glue quickly asked.
"What do you know of Lian?"
Since Roon had already spoken, Taran had no choice but to admit the companions had stumbled upon Glue's hut. Disclosing no more than he had to, Taran told of finding the recipes for the potions. Whether Glue would take kindly to strangers rummaging among his possessions, Taran did not know. To his relief, the giant showed less concern about that than he did for the fate of the mountain cat.
"Oh, Lian!" cried Glue. "If only she were here! Anything to keep me company!"
At this he buried his face in his hands, and the cavern echoed with his sobs.
"Now, now," said Fluda, "don't take on so. You're lucky you weren't gobbled up."
"Gobbled?"
sniffed Glue, raising his head.
"Better if I had been. Any doom rather than this miserable cavern. There's bats, you know. They've always terrified me, swooping and squeaking, in that nasty way they have. Crawly white worms come popping their heads out of the rocks and stare at you, and spidery things, and things that are just things. They're the worst. It's enough to curdle your blood, I tell you. The other day, if I may call it day for all the difference it makes down here..."
The giant bent forward. His voice dropped to a roaring whisper, and he appeared eager to recount these happenings at great length. "Glue," Taran interrupted, "we pity your plight. But I beg you, show us a way out of the cavern." Glue rocked his huge, scraggly head from side to side.
"Way out? I've never stopped looking for one. There isn't any. Not for me, at least."
"There must be," insisted Taran. "How did you find your way into the cave in the first place? Please, show us."
"Find my way?" replied Glue. "I should hardly call it a question of finding. It was Lian's fault. If only she hadn't broken from her cage the one time my potion was working so well,
She chased me out of my hut. Ungrateful of her, but I forgive her. I still had the flask in my hand. Oh, how I wish I'd thrown the wretched potion away. I ran as fast as I could, with Lian after me.
Glue patted his forehead with a trembling hand and blinked sorrowfully.
I've never run so fast and so far in my life, he said. I still dream of it, when I'm not dreaming of worse. Finally, I found a cave, and into it I went. I hadn't a moment to spare, continued Glue, sighing heavily. I swallowed the potion. Now that I've had time to think it over, I realize I shouldn't have. But it had made Lian so much bigger, I thought it would do the same for me, so I might have a chance against her. And so it did, he added. In fact, it worked so quickly, I nearly broke my crown on the ceiling of the cave. And I kept on growing. I had to squeeze along as fast as I could, going farther and farther downward, always looking for bigger chambers, until I ended here. By then, alas, no passage was wide enough to let me out. I've thought a great deal about it since that unhappy day. I often look back on it, Glue went on.
He half-closed his eyes and peered into the distance, lost in his own recollections.
I wonder now, he murmured, I wonder now if...
Fluda, Tyron whispered in the bard's ear, is there no way we can make him stop talking and show us one of the passages? Or should we try to slip by him and find it ourselves?
I don't know, answered Fluda. From all the giants I've seen... Yes, well, the truth of it is I've never seen any myself, though I've heard enough of them. Glue seems rather, how shall I say it, small. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but he was a feeble little fellow to begin with, and now he's a feeble little giant, and very likely a coward. I'm sure we could fight him, if we could reach him. Our biggest risk would be getting stepped on and squashed.
I'm truly sorry for him, Taran began, but I don't know how we can help him, and we dare not delay our search.
You're not listening, cried Glue,
who had been talking on at some length, before realizing he was talking mainly to himself.
Yes, it's the same thing all over again, he sobbed. Even if I'm a giant, no one pays me any mind. Oh, I can tell you there are giants who would crack your bones and squeeze you until your eyes popped. You'd listen to them, you can be sure, but not Glue. Oh, it makes no difference about him, giant or no. Glue, the giant, mewed up in a wretched cave, and who's to care? Who's even to see?
Now look here,
answered Fluda with some impatience, for the giant had begun to sob and splash the companions with tears.
You've only yourself to blame if you've put yourself into a stew. You meddled. And as I've said time and again, it leads to sad results.
I didn't want to be a giant, protested Glue. Not at first, anyway. I thought once I should be a famous warrior. I joined the host of Lord Gorion when he marched against Lord Ghast. But I couldn't stand the sight of blood. It turned me green, green as grass. And those battles, enough to make your head swim, all that clashing and smiting... The din alone is more than flesh can bear. No, no, it was absolutely out of the question.
A warrior's life is one of hardship, Taran said, and it takes a stout heart to follow it. Surely there were other means to make a name for yourself.
I thought then I might become a bard, Glue went on. It turned out as badly. The knowledge you must gain, the lore to be learned.
I'm with you there, old fellow, murmured Fluda, with a sigh of regret. I had rather the same experience.
It wasn't the years of study, explained Glue, in a voice that would have been forlorn, had it not been so loud. I knew I could have learned if I'd taken the time. No, it was my feet. I couldn't bear all the tramping and wandering around from one end of Prydain to the other, and always sleeping in a different place, and the change of water, and the harp rubbing blisters on your shoulder.
"We grieve for you," interrupted Taran, shifting restlessly. "But we cannot tarry here." Glue had crouched down in front of the companions, and Taran tried desperately to think of the best means of getting past him.
"Please, please don't go!"
cried Glue, as if reading Taran's thoughts, his eyes blinking frantically.
"Not yet.
I'll show you a passage in a moment, I promise.
Yes, yes,
shouted Gergi, at last able to bring himself to open his eyes and clamber to his feet.
Gergi does not like caverns, and his poor tender head is filled with soundings and poundings.
It was then I decided to become a hero,
Glue eagerly went on, ignoring the impatience of the companions.
To go about slaying dragons and such. But you can't imagine how difficult it is. Why, even finding a dragon is almost impossible. But I discovered one in Cantrev Moor. It was a small dragon, admitted Glue. About the size of a weasel. The cottagers had it penned up in a rabbit hutch, and the children used to go and look at it when they'd nothing else to do. But it was a dragon, nevertheless. I would have slain it,
he added with a huge, rattling sigh.
I tried, but the vicious thing bit me. I still carry the marks.
Taran tightened his grip on his sword. Glue, he said firmly, I beg you once again to show us the passage. If you will not...
Then I thought I might become a king,
Glue said hurriedly, before Taran could finish.
I thought if I could wed a princess, but no, they turned me away at the castle gate. What else could I do?
Moaned Glue, shaking his head miserably.
What was left for me but to try enchantments? At last I came upon a wizard who claimed to have a book of spells in his possession. He wouldn't tell me how it had fallen into his hands, but he assured me the magic it held was most powerful. It had once belonged to the House of Lear.
Taran caught his breath at these words. Ailanwy is a princess of the House of Lear, he whispered to the bard. What tale is Glue telling us? Is he speaking the truth?
It had come, Glue went on, from Caer Colur itself. Naturally, I...
Glue, tell me quickly, Taran cried. What is Caer Colur? What is it to do with the House of Lear?
"Why, everything," replied Glue, as though surprised at Taran's asking. "Caer Colur is the ancient seat of the House of Lear. I should think everyone would know that. A very treasure-house of charms and enchantments. Oh, my, yes. So, as I was saying, naturally, I believed I had at last found something to help me. The wizard was eager to be rid of the book, as eager as I was to have it."
Taran's hands had suddenly begun to tremble. "Where is Caer Colur?" he asked. "How can we find it?"
"Find it?" said Glue. "I don't know if there's much left of it to find. They say the castle has been in ruins for years. Bewitched, too, as you might expect, and you should have some hard rowing to do."
"Rowing over land?" said Fluda. "Don't ask us to believe that."
"Rowing?" repeated Glue, nodding sorrowfully. Long ago, Caer Colur was part of Mona, but it broke from the mainland during a flood. Now it's no more than a speck of island. Be that as it may, Glue went on, I took all the little treasure I had managed to save.
Where is the island? Taran pressed. Glue, you must tell us. It is important for us to know.
At the mouth of the Alor,
replied Glue, with a certain vexation at being interrupted once more.
But that has nothing to do with what happened to me. You see, the wizard...
Taran's mind raced. Mag had taken Ailanwy to the Alor. He had needed a boat. Was Ailanwy's ancestral home his destination? His glance met Fluda's, and the bard's expression showed he had been following the same thought.
The wizard, Glue continued, was in such haste that I had no chance to see the book until it was too late. He had cheated me. It was a book of nothing, of empty pages.
Amazing, cried Prince Roon. The very book we found.
Worthless, sighed Glue. But since you found it, you may keep it. It's yours. A gift. Something to remember me by, so you won't forget poor Glue.
Small chance of that, muttered Fluda.
"Finally, I turned to brewing my own potions," said Glue. "I wanted to be fierce. I wanted to be strong, to make all Mona tremble. Oh, it was a long labor, I tell you. Alas, you see the results. And the end of all my hopes,"
the giant glumly continued.
"Until you came along. You must help me escape from this frightful cavern. I can't stand the bats and the crawly things. It's too much, I tell you, too much. It's nasty and horrid and sticky and wet. he cried in loud despair. "I can't abide mould and mushrooms. Mould and mushrooms! I've had enough of them!"
He set to weeping again, and his pitiful moans shook the cavern. "Dalban, my master, is the most powerful enchanter in Prydain," Taran said. "It may be that he can find a means to help you. But it is your help we need now. The sooner we are free, the sooner I shall return to him."
"Too long to wait," moaned Glew. "I'll be a mushroom myself by that time."
"Help us," Taran pleaded. "Help us, and we shall try to help you." Glew said nothing for a moment. His forehead wrinkled and his lips twitched nervously.
"Very well, very well," he sighed, climbing to his feet. "Follow me. Oh, there's one thing you might do," he added. "If it would be no bother to you, it's such a little thing, if you really wouldn't mind. So at least I might have the satisfaction, however brief. A tiny favour. Would you call me King Glew?"
"Red Belin," shouted Fluda. "I'll call you King, Prince, or whatever you choose. Only show us a way out of here, sire."
Glew's spirit seemed to lift as he shambled toward the dim reaches of the cavern. The companions scrambled down the ledge and hastened to keep up with his huge strides. Glew, having spoken to no one since his confinement, never left off talking. He had, he explained, tried to brew new potions, this time to make himself smaller. In one of the chambers he had even set up a kind of workshop, where a bubbling pool of steaming hot water served to boil his concoctions. Glew's cleverness in devising makeshift pestles and mortars, cookpots and basins from painstakingly hollowed-out stones, surprised Taran and filled him with a pitying admiration for the desperate giant. But his mind turned over and over on itself, seeking an understanding that escaped him like a will-o'-the-wisp each time he drew close to it. He was certain the answer lay in the ruined halls of Caer Colur, and certain the companions would find Ailanwy there. Impatient to be gone, he ran forward as Glew halted at a chimney-like shaft of rock. Close to the ground, the dark mouth of a tunnel opened.
"Farewell," sniffed Glew, pointing sorrowfully at the tunnel. "Go straight on. You shall find your way."
"You have my word," Taran said, while Gurgi, Fluda, and Prince Roon crawled into the opening. "If it is in Dalban's power, he will help you." Clutching the bauble, Taran bent and thrust his way past the jagged arch. Bats rose in a shrieking cloud. He heard Gurgi cry out in fear and raced ahead. Next moment, he collided with a wall of stone and fell back on his heels while the bauble slipped from his grasp and dropped among the pebbles on the uneven ground. With a shout, Taran spun to see a massive rock pushed into the opening and flung himself toward it. Glew had sealed the passage. Chapter 12. The Tomb. The bard, like Taran, had dashed headlong into the wall and now struggled to his feet. Gurgi's yells rang above the screeching of the bats. Prince Roon stumbled to Taran's side and threw his weight against the immovable rock. The bauble had rolled into a corner, but one glance in the light of the glowing sphere showed Taran there was no other way in or out of the chamber.
"Glew!" Taran called, pushing with all his strength at the blocked passage. "Let us out! What have you done?"
While Gurgi, jabbering furiously, beat his fists against the unyielding stone, Taran plunged against it once more. Beside him, he heard Prince Roon gasping with his own efforts. Fluda shoved and heaved mightily, lost his footing, and sprawled to earth.
"Little worm!" the bard shouted at the top of his voice. "Liar! You betrayed us!"
From the other side of the stone came Glew's muffled voice.
"I'm very sorry. Forgive me. But what else am I to do?"
"Let us out!"
Taran demanded again, still straining to move the rock. With a sob half of anger and half of despair, he dropped to earth and scrabbled desperately at the loose pebbles.
"Move aside, heavy stone, evil, wicked little giant!"
shouted Gurgi.
"Take away lockings and blockings, or rageful Gurgi will smack your great feeble head!"
"We would have done you a kindness!" Taran cried, "and you repay us with treachery."
"I say, that's true enough," called Prince Roon. "How do you expect anyone to help you if they're buried in here?"
faint though it was, a sobbing sound drifted from beyond the blocked passageway.
"Too long," moaned the voice of Glue. "Too long! I can't wait no more in this ghastly cave. Who knows whether Dalban would care about my fate? Very likely he wouldn't. It must be done now. Now!"
"Glue," Taran said, forcing himself to be as calm and patient as he could, for he was convinced the giant had taken leave of his senses. "There is nothing we alone can do for you, or we would have done it before this."
"But there is! There is!" cried Glue. "You shall help me with my potions. I'm sure I can brew another to bring me back to size. That's all I ask. Is that too much?"
"If you want us to help you cook up more of those dreadful messes you fed Lian," called Fluda, "you're taking a curious way to win our friendship."
The bard hesitated, and his eyes widened in sudden dismay.
"Great Balin," he murmured, "as he did with Lian."
Even as the bard spoke, Taran's legs began to quake, for the same thought had occurred to him. "Fluda," he whispered, "he is indeed out of his wits. This cavern has driven him mad."
"Not a bit of it," replied the bard. "It makes excellent sense in a nasty, horrible fashion. He has no one else to try his concoctions on."
He pressed to the stone and cupped his hands around his mouth.
"You shan't do that, you wretched, snivelling worm!" he shouted. "We won't swallow your evil stews, even if you starve us. And if you try to cram them down our throats, you'll learn that a flam can bite."
"I promise," pleaded Glue, "you won't have to swallow a thing. I'll take all the risks myself. Terrible risks they are, too. Suppose I should turn into a puff of smoke and blow away? You never know when you're dealing with such recipes. It could happen."
"I wish it would," muttered Fluda.
"No, no," Glue went on. "This won't hurt you a bit, you can be sure. It won't take more than a moment of your time, half a moment, and I shall only need one of you, only one. You can't say that's asking too much. You can't be so selfish."
Glue's voice had risen to a frenzy, and he had begun shouting and wailing so loudly and rapidly, Taran could barely make out the words. But, as he listened, Taran felt the blood drain from his heart. A chill held and shook him as Glue babbled on. "Glue," he cried, despair welling up in him, "what do you mean to do with us?"
"Please, please try to understand," returned Glue's voice. "It's my only chance. I'm sure it will work. I've thought it over carefully ever since I've been in this awful hole. I know I can brew the right potion. I have all I need, except one thing, one tiny little ingredient. It won't hurt you a bit. You won't feel a thing. I swear it to you."
Taran gasped in horror.
"You mean to kill one of us?"
There was a long silence. Finally, Glue's voice reached the companions again. It sounded as though Glue's feelings had been hurt.
"You make it sound so raw."
"Great Balin," shouted Fluda, "let me get my hands on your scrawny neck, and I'll make you sound raw."
There was another silence.
"Please," said Glue faintly, "try to look at it from my side."
"Gladly," said Fluda. "Just push away that rock."
"Don't think it's easy for me," Glue went on. "I'm fond of all of you, especially the little fuzzy one, and I feel dreadful about the whole thing, but there's no chance anyone else will stop down here. You do understand that, don't you? You aren't angry. I'd never forgive myself if you were. Even now," he added plaintively, "I don't know how I'll ever bring myself to pick out one of you. No, no, I can't. I haven't the heart. Don't ask me to put myself through that torment. No, you shall decide among you. That will be best all around. Believe me," Glue continued, "it will be worse for me than for you. But I'll shut my eyes, so I won't see which one of you it is. Then, after it's over, we'll try to forget about it. We'll be the best of good friends, those of you remaining, that is. I'll lead you out of here, I promise. We'll find Lian. Oh, it will be good to see her again, and all will be well. Don't go away, said Glue. I'll get a few things ready. I won't keep you waiting.
Glue, listen to me, called Tyron. This is an evil deed you plan. Set us free.
No answer came. The rock did not move.
Dig, friends, cried Fruda, drawing his sword. Dig for your lives.
Tyron and Gurgi unsheathed their blades, and side by side attacked the ground beneath the ponderous stone. With all their strength they thrust into the rocky, unyielding earth. Their sword points rang on the pebbles, but try as they would, they could barely scrape away more than a shallow hole. Prince Roon sought to force his sword under the rock, but succeeded only in snapping the point off the blade. Tyron picked up the bauble. Bending to hands and knees, he scanned every portion of this prison, hoping to find some crack or tiny opening the companions could enlarge. The walls rose sheer and unbroken. "He has trapped us well," said Tyron, sinking to the ground. "There is but one way out, the way Glue offers us."
"As I consider it," said Roon, "he asked for only one of us. That would leave three to keep searching for the princess."
Tyron was thoughtful for a moment.
"For the first time," he said bitterly, "I believed I had guessed where Mag meant to bring Ailanwy. To Caer Colur. It is the strongest clue we have gained. Now it is useless to us."
"Useless?" said Roon. "Not at all. We need only do as Glue suggests, and the others can be on their way."
"You expect that feeble worm to keep his word?" Fluda asked angrily. "I would trust him every bit as much as I would trust Mag."
"Nevertheless," said Roon, "we can't be sure until we try."
The companions fell silent at the Prince of Mona's words. Gurgi, who had crouched on the earth and wrapped his woolly arms around his knees, stared wretchedly at Tyron.
"Gurgi will go,"
the creature whispered faintly, though he trembled so much he could hardly speak.
"Yes, yes, he will give his poor tender head for broilings and boilings."
"Valiant Gurgi," murmured Tyron, "indeed I know you would give up your poor tender head." He patted the frightened Gurgi. "But there is no question of that. We must stand together. If Glue wants a life, he shall pay dearly for it." Fluda once more began digging and chipping at the rock.
"I agree with you entirely," he said. "We must stand as one, to the extent that we have any choice at all. As soon as the little fellow comes back... Oh, drat and blast! I don't know why I keep thinking of him as a little fellow, except that he impresses me that way, no matter what his size. He'll surely seize one of us. He hasn't the honour of a flea or the heart of a gnat, and he's desperate. If we fight him, there's a good chance all of us shall be slain."
"You cannot mean we should take Glue's bargain," said Tyron.
"Certainly not," replied Fluda. "I shall stand sword in hand and smite the little fellow about the knees, since I can't reach his head. I only mean to point out the risks. As far as his ridiculous idea of having us choose among ourselves is concerned, I don't think it's even worth a thought."
"I do," said Prince Roon.
Tyron turned in surprise to Roon, not fully understanding his words. The Prince of Mona grinned at him, almost shyly.
"It's the only thing that will satisfy Glue," said Roon, "and for that I think it's a very cheap bargain."
"No life can be so cheaply held," Tyron began.
"I'm afraid you're wrong," answered Roon.
He smiled and shook his head. "I've thought a great deal about this since we've been in the cavern, and there's no sense not facing facts. I don't see that I've been any help whatever. On the contrary, I brought nothing but ill luck. Not that I meant to, but it seems that's the way of it with me. So if any one of us can be dispensed with, why, I should have to say that person is myself."
"It's true,"
Roon quickly went on, disregarding Taran's cry of protest.
"I'm delighted to be of some use for once, especially if it will help Ailanwy. I assure you I won't mind in the slightest. As Glue says, it will only take a moment."
"There's not one of you who wouldn't give up his life for a companion," Roon added. Fluda Flam offered his life for ours in Lian's lair. Even now, poor Gergi is willing to offer his.
He raised his head.
A bard, a humble creature.